This is Embodied, our space to talk sex, relationships, and health. I'm Anita Rao. It is one of the first acts a parent can do for a baby. And yet nursing always seems to be shrouded in controversy. There's the recurring debate over whether or not it's appropriate to do in public, and I'm going to settle that one right now. It is. Years of well-intentioned advice from medical organizations that breast is best is now being met with pushback for making parents feel like failures if they don't succeed in nursing their baby. And we also don't talk openly about the physical realities of lactation, how it leaves nipples raw and butts tired from sitting for hours. It can also leave parents with unanswered questions like, what if I don't have enough milk? Or what if I've had chest surgery? To help us all get a better understanding of lactation and nursing, there is someone I would like us to meet, Jania Williams. Jania is a lactation consultant and the program director of the Pathway to Human Lactation Training Program at North Carolina A&T State University. Welcome, Jania.
Thank you so much for having me, Anita.
This is a special show because it is our inaugural Embodied the Radio Show episode. So we're thrilled to have you and thrilled that everyone is joining us today. So I'd love to just start with some lactation basics. The science of breast milk is so cool. I feel like we could geek out on just that for an hour. But just in a short description, what is human milk made of?
Yeah, so human milk is actually composed of like hundreds and thousands of distinct bioactive molecules, and a lot of them aren't even fully understood yet by scientists themselves, but it's primarily composed of water, carbs or carbohydrates, lipids and proteins, and then all of those nutrients, of course, play a role in contributing to infant growth and development. And then with that, human milk also contains those antibodies that help babies fight off viruses and bacteria in the beginning. And it helps line their gastrointestinal tract, revs up their immune system, and protects their brain.
One of the fascinating things to me that is that there's kind of this call and response system between a baby's immune system and the milk that is being produced. Could you talk about that and how that interacts?
Yeah. So, and it's so funny because I was talking to my students about human milk composition before the show this morning, and we were discussing how over a course of time it changes, even from like if you are nursing an infant at 1 a.m. and then you nurse that same infant again at 12 p.m., how the body changes to meet the baby's specific needs. But to directly answer your question with human milk composition, it's also tailored immunity through babies, what we call really backwash. I'm like, I don't even know how else to say that. But it's basically during nursing, the sucking that the vacuum that is created on a parent's chest or breast, it forces a mixture of breast milk and saliva into the intake of the actual parent's nipple, and that creates the autoimmune response to the baby's cells, and it helps them fight off infections.
I love it. Backwash is useful. You heard it here first.
Backwash.
Well, I mean, it raises the question of recommendations. And I know just in the process of getting ready for the show and some conversations we've been having online this week, there is, it's a heated topic to have. People's feelings are really strong, and hearing medical recommendations about what you should or shouldn't do can be really challenging for folks for a variety of reasons. We'll unpack that throughout the show. But I guess I'd love to understand the recommendations that we do have right now that are most standard. What are those, and why do those exist?
Yeah, so we tend to lean towards here, of course, in North America, what the American Academy of Pediatrics is saying. And so they recommend exclusive nursing for 6 months, and then you can continue nursing after you introduce what we call complementary foods until your child is 12 months or older. And that's just their statement. And then there's the World Health Organization, or the WHO, and they recommend exclusive nursing up to 6 months of age, with continued nursing with the complementary foods up to 2 years or longer. And so I think, and in fact, I talked to a pediatrician the other day, I think we need to get away from hard stopping with these guidelines, because most people in healthcare professions tend to hard stop when we look at guidelines like 12 months, 2 years. And I always tell parents, do what's best at your address. And if it's working for you all, then continue along with it, because there are also extended benefits to human milk. And my go-to is always, oh, well, Michael Jordan was nursed until 3 years old. And we know now with studies that children, if they're nursed past the age of 24 months, they have better hand-eye coordination. And look how well that played out for him.
So that's interesting. And I mean, it makes me wonder kind of what is your response to folks who do use formula for a variety of reasons, who are wanting to know about the differences in what mm-hmm. that provides versus breast milk?
Yeah. And so I think that that's really a conversation that we have to be careful with, because we don't want to force our own thoughts and opinions onto other parents. So the way that I address that situation is I learn a little bit more about what they know about nursing, what they know about human milk and the benefits for themselves and their little nurser. And we discuss that, because culturally it depends on, you know, sometimes we haven't seen other people who look like us nurse, or we think that, some parents know I have to go back to work in X amount of weeks. I don't have time to express my milk, so let me go ahead now and do formula. People don't know that they can do both. You can formula feed and you can feed your milk to your child. So it's just kind of meeting people where they are and tailoring feeding plans to that.
I want to hear a clip from a listener who shared their experience. We heard a lot of folks saying that it's a learning process. You kind of have to realize that it is not natural for everyone. You're on your own journey. And here is a listener named Amber who shared her experience.
I'm Amber Cruz. I'm here in Durham, and I am a lesbian mama nursing a now 3-year-old, and I'm the birth mom, and her mommy is the adoptive mom. And we're just waking up from nap. I had always expected to breastfeed. That's one of the main reasons we decided to have a biological child, because it's easier, not impossible, to lactate without pregnancy. But I wanted that experience. And I ended up having a pretty massive oversupply. So it was quite a journey for almost a year. Also, extended nursing is a thing that I now know about and didn't as having an infant.
So that's Amber Cruz of Durham. And I have a lot of questions for you, but I guess I'd love to hear your reaction to that clip.
Yeah. And so, and that's the thing. There's really not a time frame or a time limit on how long you have to nurse your baby or you should nurse your baby. I, in fact, have a 2-year-old, well, he's almost 2.5, and we are still nursing from time to time. And people sometimes think it's strange or it's weird or it's odd. And then I have to tell them, you know, I'm doing this because this is what we have chosen to do. And with nursing, it has to be a mutual relationship. And because there's two people involved. And so as long as it's working for the nursing parent and it's working for the baby, then I say, go ahead and continue. And then when it stops working from one member of the party, then we need to start talking about how we can alter those things.
We'll talk about some of those. We've talked a bit about nutritional benefits and some of that science, but how about the psychological components of bonding, both what nursing allows for that and how folks can get those same kinds of bonds if they're not able to nurse?
Yeah. And so in my former role as a speech language pathologist, I worked with parents in NICU settings who had babies who could not nurse. And so a lot of them kind of beat themselves up because they had heard, oh, you won't be able to bond with your baby if you're not putting your baby to your breast or your chest. You are going to miss out on those benefits. And that's not necessarily true, because you can certainly feed babies human milk and have that same eye-to-eye contact. You can still do skin-to-skin. You can still bond with your child in other ways besides feeding. And then for those people who choose to nurse or chest feed, you are able to start early on with establishing your milk supply in a faster way. And really, that's the difference. It psychologically, there are ways to bond with your child regardless of how you choose to feed them from the start.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment, but I want to invite you all to join us. You can join us on social media. We're at EmbodiedWUNC on both Twitter and Instagram. We also have a new, fresh, shiny inbox that has plenty of room in it for your thoughts and questions. So go ahead and send us an email to embodied@wunc.org. Jania Williams is a lactation consultant and the program director of the Pathway to Human Lactation Training Program at North Carolina A&T State University. She's going to stick with us just ahead as we talk about some of the messy and complicated realities of breastfeeding and ways that parents have found what's best for them and their child as they're nursing. Join the conversation by finding us at EmbodiedWUNC on Twitter and Instagram. You're listening to Embodied from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is Embodied from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anisha Rao. Not everyone who nurses has breasts, which makes the term breastfeeding inaccurate and alienating to transgender parents. That's why on today's show, we are using the terms chest feeding and nursing. There are all sorts of other misconceptions about nursing, some that are rooted in gender bias and others that were baked into culture by slavery and racism and still affect Black folks who nurse today. Lactation consultant Jania Williams is with me on this learning journey, and I want to introduce you now to two other guests, Trevor McDonald and Amina Shakur. Trevor is a researcher, transgender parent, and lactation activist. Hey, Trevor.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Thanks for being here. And Amina is an artist, art historian, and graduate student in art and design. Amina, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we invite all of you to add your voice to the conversation at EmbodiedWUNC on Twitter. And just a heads up, we will be discussing sexual assault later on in this conversation. So, Amina, I would love to start with you and a bit of your own story. And you have written a variety of things about your experience. And in one of them, you said a line that stood out to me, which said that you had this desire to give your baby everything that you didn't have as an adoptee in a poor family, and made me think about how these early experiences of our own childhood impact what we want to do in terms of nursing and raising our kids later on. I'd love to hear a bit more about how your early experiences impacted your desire to nurse.
Okay, so I was a transracial adoptee, so I'm Indigenous and was adopted by a white family, and a poor white family, because, of course, in this country, even poor white families can adopt children of color much cheaper and easier than adopting white children. And so I was taken away from my tribe, and along with my brother, and because we also were disabled, that also made it a little bit easier. And we were adopted by a poor white family, and they had never been able to have children. My adoptive mother never experienced pregnancy, so she really lived very vicariously through me with my pregnancy. Mm. But because she had never had any of those experiences, she didn't have the experience of trying to decide whether she wanted to nurse and, you know, anything about all of those choices that you make when you're planning for or unexpectedly become pregnant and start figuring out how you're going to approach certain things. So I went to the library. I had never intended to have children, having been adopted, having been abused, having experienced a lot of sexual violence in my life. It had never been my intention to have children. And then I had certain illnesses that caused doctors to tell me that I probably wouldn't be able to have children. And I had a couple of really bad miscarriages at a very young age. And being told that I probably couldn't made me kind of think maybe I do want to.
Oh, yes. I know that.
which is absolutely not to say that that is true for everyone. Some people, that is such a great relief, obviously. But for me, I kind of was like, oh, well. So we thought, you know, oh, this baby is sort of a miracle that it has survived as far as it, as long as it did at the point that I found out that I was pregnant. And so we were kind of excited about it. And I wanted to do everything that I could to, you know, understanding that this was going to be the only child I was going to have. I actually got my tubes tied the day after he was born. We planned that out with a great deal of support and discussion with my medical providers throughout my pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's... we knew he was going to be the only one. So I was like, you know, I want to give him everything that I didn't have, and that, you know, I'm not having to split my energy between multiple children. So he literally gets everything. Hmm.
So you went in with all of these ideas, these hopes, these stories that you were writing for your potential self, and then you ended up not being able to nurse as long as you expected. Tell us a bit about what happened.
Well, so I actually had a condition that caused a problem where I had been told that, you know, the child is appropriately latched on correctly because you won't because it's not painful. Hmm. That if it's painful, that means they're not latched on correct. And that was not true because when he latched on correctly, it sent a shooting pain down my spine that was absolutely unbearable. It literally made me want to throw him away from me, which I will say is really, really bad for bonding.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that pain lasted for the entire time that he was eating. And in his case, he was also just his personality. He's still this type of person at 24. He was the sort of baby who would pull off and then latch back on repeatedly. So it was constant pain while he ate. And it was really not tenable.
Yeah.
And then what happened was when he was 2.5 weeks old, he had a seizure and went into the hospital and ended up spending a week in the hospital while they tried to determine what was going on. And in that time, it just didn't make sense to be fighting to get him fed and me being uncomfortable and tense. I wanted to be able to comfort him through whatever it was that he was going through. So we switched to finding the right formula and bottle feeding him so that would be one less tension and stress for his tiny body.
Totally. And we'll come back. Yeah, we'll come back to your story in a second and hear about kind of how your thoughts about this time have evolved as you became a doula and learned some more about your own experience. We'll come back to that in a second. I want to turn quickly now to Trevor McDonald, who we introduced at the top, a researcher, a transgender parent, and lactation activist, and hear a bit about your story. Trevor, you went into the thought process of nursing, thinking that you weren't going to be able to nurse because you had had chest surgery. So tell me a bit about your research process and what led you to kind of figure out what you were going to do.
Yeah, that's great. So I had had chest masculinization surgery as a part of my transition. And so I thought, well, I don't have breasts, so there's not going to be breastfeeding. And that was just the assumption that I made. But early in my first pregnancy, a really close friend of mine, she offered me some information. And she just offered it in the most gentle way imaginable. Mm. She was a La Leche League leader at the time. La Leche League is an international support organization for breastfeeding and chest feeding parents. And anyway, she gave me this book and she said, I don't know if you would be interested in reading this or not. I don't know if it would even be relevant to you, but you can take a look at it if you want. And it was a book by Diana West. The title is Defining Your Own Success, Breastfeeding After Reduction Surgery. And it was just such a gentle way of offering this, like without any pressure whatsoever. And so I did glance at the book and then actually I ended up reading the whole thing. And I learned so much from that book, even just starting with the title, Defining Your Own Success.
Yeah.
That nursing a baby doesn't have to be all or nothing. That some amount of milk can be helpful, and that sometimes even after having had a reduction surgery or a chest contouring surgery like I had, sometimes it is still possible to produce a little bit of milk. And I learned from that book that there is value in the relationship itself. And that even if you don't produce a single drop of milk, that there can be value to feeding a baby at your chest. There's actually, there's a device called a supplemental nursing system that allows people to feed their baby at their own breast or chest, but feed them supplement if they're not making enough of their own milk. And it's a really simple device that can be totally homemade if someone wants to. It's really just a thin feeding tube going into whatever container of supplement you're using. Now, it's a lot harder to use than it maybe sounds like.
I was just going to say, I my sister has actually had to use an SNS, and I saw it in action, and it may be a simple technology, but it's so difficult. It requires like 8 hands to figure out how to juggle the
sharp learning curve.
Yeah. Well, I guess it raises this question of, you know, there is this spectrum of, you know, the amount of milk someone can produce, and, you know, how they want to supplement and how they want to provide other ways to feed their child. And so you were able to figure out that you were able to produce more milk than you expected. But through this process, you kind of began to realize how little your providers were able to really inform you on that process. And I'm curious about your work with other trans folks that you've kind of started in the wake of this. What have you learned about the experiences of learning what's possible as a trans parent wanting to chest feed? What is that experience like?
Well, early on, I started doing a couple of sort of more public facing things. I started writing a blog about my personal experiences. And I started getting a lot of questions through the blog from other trans and non-binary people, and also from healthcare providers who wanted to know more. And I started to get really uncomfortable about answering questions like that just from my one experience,
mm-hmm.
because I knew that there's this huge variety of experiences out there. The reason that I knew that is that at about the same time, I started a support group on Facebook for trans and non-binary people interested in nursing their babies. And when I started that group, I thought, oh, you know, maybe 10 people will eventually be with me in this group. But it grew and grew and now has many thousands of members. And just hearing anecdotally all these different stories of very different experiences made me feel like, wow, there's research here that needs to be done in a formal academic way so that it can be shared with providers, so that providers can access this information and learn. And so I put together a research team, and yeah, that's what we did. We interviewed 22 study participants who had experiences with pregnancy, birth, and infant feeding, and who identified as transmasculine. And and we've since published 2 research papers about our work.
That's wonderful. I'm going to come back and ask you some questions about that research in a little bit, but I want to turn to Jania Williams, our lactation consultant and lactation training program director, and reflect on and what I've heard both Amina and Trevor talk about, which is these narratives that you go into the feeding experience with, whether they be personal, you know, social, cultural, and you've worked with a lot of Black families who have very particular feeding experiences because of cultural narratives that have been inherited or told directly to them. And I'd love to know about some of those and how they shape the experiences of Black folks wanting to nurse.
Yeah, definitely. And I think with marginalized populations that we need to be very careful as healthcare providers when we go into these conversations to support and educate these families. For the Black families that I serve primarily, for a support group standpoint, we know that there is a long history in the United States, of slavery. And a lot of things tie back to that, including wet nursing And for people who may not know what wet nursing is, it's basically informal milk sharing. But during slavery, it was something that enslaved people were made to do. They were having to nurse their master's children before their own children. And that also kind of perpetuated the narrative that Black children are weaker, Black children are less healthy, because think about all the benefits that are attached to and tied to human milk. In addition to that, as time went on, formula marketing came about, and it became a social status, and Black families wanted to show that they were able to do better. And so they would say, you know, well, I'm going to formula feed because nursing is something that poor people do. And as time went on again, in the 80s and the 90s, there were increased formula marketing towards and directed, I think really it was targeted towards Black families, because we know that representation matters. And when you see someone who looks like you doing one thing, you start to develop a mindset of, this is what I am supposed to do. And we know Black families too, the research is there. They're offered formula at higher rates than whites in hospital settings instead of help, education, and support. And then the last thing that I always talk about when we discuss this topic is the lack of representation that's in the actual field of lactation. Think about who's leading the support groups in the community. Think about who the lactation consultants are in the hospital setting, in the health department settings. Rarely do you find any who identify as Black, and it's because less than 1.5% of international board certified lactation consultants are Black.
And you've really been on a mission to change that within North Carolina, and because of your own personal experience. I read that at one point you a photo of you was used to advertise to other folks who are Black who wanted to lactate. And it was used for almost 10 years, the same photograph, because they couldn't find anyone else. And I'd love to hear a bit about that and what you're trying to do to kind of diversify the kinds of stories we know about Black folks who are trying to nurse their kids.
Yeah, and it's all about, you know, I'm just really trying to change the narrative. But that's how I got into this work. I had my first son, who's now 13, back in 2007. And at the time, the hospital system was changing their marketing. And they said, you know, blatantly stated, we need a picture of a person of color who is nursing. Would you be willing to do this? Literally, it was 3 hours after I had my child. And so I said, okay, sure, sign me up. And I thought it was just, you know, going to be like this small picture, but it ended up being this huge picture. And at the time, our hospital system was heading towards the baby-friendly path. And so they were getting rid of their nursery. And they took all these huge pictures and put them in place of the nursery. And it stayed there until this past February. It's been a year now. And so the hospital moved, but when they moved, I got the copy of the picture. But people started stopping me because they would say, hey, you know, Black families, you look like me. I know that you nursed. Can you help me? Can you answer these questions for me? And that's what I ended up doing. I changed professions and became a lactation consultant to make sure that people had evidence-based information and to help kind of change the face of lactation and showing people that, yes, we do this too.
There are so many more narratives we're going to explore as we continue our conversation after the break. Janiyah Williams, our lactation consultant, will stay with us, as well as Amina Shakur and Trevor McDonald. But I want to close out the segment hearing from another one of our listeners in Durham, talking about their personal experience of nursing and all of the many unexpected pieces of it. Let's listen.
I expected nursing to be easy. I imagined that I would be nursing a baby in one hand, sitting in a rocking chair and reading a book in the other hand, and the wind would be blowing and everything would be perfect. And newborns come out very floppy. And if I felt like it took four hands to be able to breastfeed. I had to have someone wiggle his toes to keep him awake. And I needed two hands, and one to hold my breast and one to hold the baby's head and someone to feed me water. And there was so much to learn.
expectations, challenges, and everything we still have to learn. We'll keep talking about that as we talk about lactation and nursing on Embodied today. Stay with us after the break. This is our show about sex, relationships, and health, Embodied. I'm Anita Rao. Once you sign up to be a parent, you know it is not going to be a walk in the park, at least not all the time. We're talking about some of the many parenting challenges today, and especially feeding a baby. And we're going to get back to that conversation in just a second, but I want to plant a quick seed in your mind about our show next week. It's another meetings of our brains and our bodies as we talk about human endurance, and we want to know your stories. What does endurance mean to you? Was there a time that you tested the limits of your own physical strength, and what was that like? Email us embodied@wunc.org or send us a DM on Instagram or Twitter. We're at embodiedwunc. Now back to our conversation about nursing. I'm talking with Trevor McDonald, a researcher, transparent, and lactation activist. Amina Shakur, an artist, art historian, and art and design graduate student. Jania Williams, a lactation consultant and lactation training program director. And Amina, I want to start back with you and hear a little bit more about your experiences training as a doula and what you learned specifically about the connection between your experience of sexual assault and how that shaped nursing. It led you on a journey to create this really beautiful resource guide for other folks who have experienced sexual assault who are thinking about nursing. And I'd love to know a bit more about how you got to that point.
Yeah. So in 2014, I started the path of becoming a doula. I never actually completed the process. I went through a ton of training and wasn't able to get an apprenticeship in my area, really due to transphobia and ableism, unfortunately. But in the process of doing that, a lot of what led me to do that was having more open discussions with friends, including some friends who were working in that field, around the issues of sexual violence and trauma, and coming to terms with the fact that there's just an awful lot about childbearing that was impacted for me by a history of sexual violence. And the issues are really very much around issues of body autonomy and control, mostly. And that looks different for different people. So, you know, for example, one of my friends said that she wanted to have a C-section because she felt that being put under, even though that took away her control, it felt like a different sense of lack of control than being out of control in the sense and aware of being out of control. Since then, she's had six more kids that she's all had by free birth. So where she has felt a great deal of control by doing it that way. So it looks different for everyone, right? I think nursing is also sort of like that, where there's a sense of wonder in what your body can do. And it's amazing to be able to imagine that you can nourish another body, another human, that you can bear and then actually feed and watch a body grow outside of yourself because of what your body produces. And that's really interesting, but you're not prepared, and we don't have a lot of trauma-informed lactation consultants, and that ties back to the issue of not having a lot of diversity in lactation consultants as well.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what advice you'd give to parents who are survivors and who are nursing, because in this piece you lay out one of the things that really caught my eye was this idea of setting boundaries based off of kind of what in real time feels comfortable. And I know you have a couple examples of how to set those kinds of boundaries, and I'd love to hear maybe one or two of those.
Yeah. One friend said that something that really bothered her a lot was having like her nipple played with by the baby. So she just very early on, and that's the one that has seven children, so she's done this with a lot of them. She just really early on started taking their hand and very gently taking it away from her other nipple and saying no, and literally asserting that boundary and teaching them from very early on. And And I agree with her that babies are absolutely brilliant and they can absorb whatever it is that you throw at them. So if you tell them no, they start to understand what that concept is and what your boundaries are. There are other things, though, too, that I think it's really worth recognizing when you're uncomfortable that it's okay that you feel uncomfortable. Even when you aren't able to articulate the why, because sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have no idea why you feel the way that you feel yet. Or you have an inkling, but you're not sure that it's safe to articulate it or that anyone will understand it or whatever the case may be. It's okay to lean into it, though, and to just say, I don't feel comfortable with this, so I'm not going to do this.
Yeah. Jania.
And it's okay. One of the things that I was told was, if you're going to breastfeed, then under no circumstances should you be bottle feeding. And, I mean, that's a lot of hooey. you can do both. You can do a mix. You really can do what works for you.
Yeah.
Regardless of what anyone else says.
Completely.
You get to set the boundaries that work for you, however they are, whatever they are. And you get to change your mind. I think that's the biggest thing, is I think a lot of parents feel like when they have made a decision, I think, first of all, that a lot of parents don't feel that they've been given enough information to make a solid decision.
Totally. And I want to...
parents should get all of that.
Totally.
But then they feel like they're stuck in that decision.
Jania,
I'm never stuck.
Yeah. I only have about a minute left for this question, Jania, but I mean, you're really working to bring more diversity into the field of lactation consultants so people can respond in real time to these concerns and give more sensitive and appropriate advice. Could you just tell me briefly about the program that you're creating and what you hope its impact will be?
Yeah. So what we have at North Carolina A&T State University is the Pathway 2 Human Lactation Training Program. And our program is grounded in, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And what I'm trying to do is change the face of lactation, literally and figuratively. I'm trying to, of course, make more lactation consultants who are Black or of color, but I'm also trying to make more lactation consultants who can understand cultural humility and be able to meet our patients, whomever they are and however they identify where they are, in order to make them feel safe and to provide them with evidence-based education and support. So our students learn everything from biases to implicit biases to race, sex, gender, and religion, and how to work with all people that they'll encounter in healthcare.
Jania Williams, a lactation consultant and lactation training program director. I was also talking with Amina Shakur, an artist, art historian, and graduate student. I'm going to ask Trevor to stay with us, but Amina and Jania, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us, Amina.
So we're going to talk a little bit more now about what folks can do when they maybe don't have the supply that they want. And that can be turning to a milk bank or a milk sharing system. And we have a professor with us who has studied that and studied how those are impacted in times of crises. Anjali Palmquist is an assistant professor in the Department of Maternal and Child Health at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. Anjali, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So tell me about milk banks and milk sharing, what they are and what they provide for folks.
So milk banks are an institution that in North America, we have the Human Milk Banking Association of North America, and they are an institution that helps to facilitate the safe provision of pasteurized donor human milk, primarily to infants in the neonatal intensive care unit or other medically fragile infants. In situations where their parent isn't able to provide enough milk or the infant for some any other reason needs to be supplemented. So milk banks collect donations of human milk from other healthy lactating individuals. They kind of collect it. They go through a very rigorous medical screening, a behavioral screening. And then that milk is pooled together and it's pasteurized using what's called Holder pasteurization. And then it's distributed to hospitals. And in some circumstances, some milk banks do provide this pasteurized donor human milk to infants who are discharged. Milk sharing is somewhat different because these are basically gifts of human milk, expressed human milk from one parent to another for the purpose of infant feeding. And so these are direct exchanges, for example, between family members or close friends within parenting groups. You often have a situation where there are parents who really want to nurse their baby or provide expressed human milk for their baby, but they maybe don't have an inadequate supply. Maybe they're an adoptive parent, and they're really interested in feeding their baby with human milk. And so they'll do that through what's called milk sharing. And so these two practices have a lot in common because it's sort of grounded by a high value of human milk. But sort of the peer-to-peer milk sharing exchanges happen in a much more sort of personal relationship in the context of those relationships rather than going through an institution. And that milk that is exchanged between peers is often, you know, raw human milk, unpasteurized, sort of just directly given from one person's freezer to someone else.
Yeah, well, Trevor, you have direct experience with this, really wanted to feed your children only with human milk, and you found milk donors. Tell me about this process of collecting, of connecting with other folks.
Yeah, well, we don't have a formal milk bank in my region at all. And our infant was not medically fragile, so he would not have qualified anyway through that type of system. So we did turn to milk sharing, and we had the most amazing milk donors, because I think what you learn when you do start in on this process, trying to feed your baby in this way, is that there are a lot of other parents out there that are just as passionate as you are about feeding human milk, and they really care. It was such an amazing experience. So I'll give you one example of a milk donor that we met. She had successfully breastfed her first baby, and then her second child was born premature. And she tried and tried and tried, but she could not get this baby to latch. And so she was exclusively pumping for her baby. Also, she suffered a bout of mastitis, which is an infection. And her doctor's advice had been, well, to make sure you don't get mastitis again, ensure that every time you pump, you fully drain both breasts. And so she really took this advice to heart, and she pumped her milk and pumped her milk. She ended up filling a large freezer, like a standalone freezer, just with bags of human milk.
Wow.
Of her milk. And so when we first got in touch with her, I mean, you never know when you are meeting a milk donor how much is a lot of milk to that person, because honestly, any amount of human milk is precious, and we were grateful for any kind of help. But when we first met her, she said over the phone, like, can you guys bring a large cooler? Because my freezer is absolutely full. I don't want this to go to waste, but I really do want to stock up on some bread from Costco. I want to put that in my freezer.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, Anjali, that's such a powerful story to think about, that kind of human-to-human connection. But obviously, thinking about that in the context of COVID-19 is so different. I know you study disasters and how they impact nursing, and we have so little time in the show to explore it. But just, briefly, I'd love to know how COVID has affected these networks of folks donating and finding supplemental human milk.
We see a really diverse range of responses. And so I think within some of our cursory exploration of what people are doing related to milk sharing in the context of COVID-19, we see definitely an increase in people's interest in and awareness of, like, the immune properties of human milk, and people wanting to, you know, if they are lactating, they have recovered from COVID-19, sort of acknowledging that and saying, I survived COVID-19 and I have milk to donate. We also have situations where some, you know, the milk banks are having to align their policies and practices with the emerging evidence around keeping the supply of donor human milk that's dispensed by milk banks up to their standards. And so there's an interest in donating, but oftentimes there are some barriers. So as Trevor was talking, I recalled a physician reaching out to me and saying, I have a patient who has 3,000 ounces of milk, and she was taking some kind of supplement. She can't give it to a milk bank. Like, what does she do with this? So we sort of see these networks adapting, and I think there is also an increased interest and demand for pasteurized donor human milk in the hospital setting as a result of COVID-19, because many hospital policies sometimes are disruptive to lactation. They're not as supportive of lactation, which increases the need for supplementation immediately postpartum, along with sort of different conditions that make lactation nursing or expressing milk more difficult. And so within hospital settings, there's an increased demand, but you also have more disruptive lactation happening in the community, and less donation to milk banks happening. So we're kind of seeing a lot of things emerging in different spaces of this area.
All right. I'm so sorry to say we have to end the show there. We have much more to talk about than we have time for, but thanks so much to both of you for being with us. Anjali Palmquist, an assistant professor in the Department of Maternal and Child Health at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health, and Trevor McDonald, a lactation activist and researcher. We will link to Trevor's study at our website. You can find that at WUNC.org. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Next week, remember, we are talking about human endurance, and we want to know your stories of pushing yourself to the limits of physical strength. Email us embodied@wunc.org. Embodied is produced by Kaya Finlay and edited by Amanda Magnus. Elkham Dodor is our intern, Jenny Lawson, our technical director, and Al Widarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao. I'll be with you here each Friday, taking on the taboo in conversation. Join us next week.